Welcome, everyone. My name is Klaus Weber. I'm the Deputy Director of the Northwestern Buffett Institute for Global Affairs. And this is part of our webinar series, Confronting COVID-19, Global Implications and Futures. One thing that the pandemic has clearly exposed is many pre-existing issues about societal systems and institutions. And this is not only in the US, but worldwide. That includes employment, access to health, and education, for example. The political and government responses to the pandemic have in many cases amplified these issues, or at least brought them to the fore. And they point to the importance of interrogating the sources of those deficits in those systems and institutions, and to really explore viable alternatives. And today's seminar is really about that big question. We're very lucky to have with us today two experts in the politics of education and learning who will help us think carefully about educational discourse, policy, and practice amidst COVID-19. Sally Nyama is an assistant professor of urban politics and human development and social policy at Northwestern, and she studies the intersection of race, gender, education policy, and political behavior. Her book, How Girls Achieve, illuminates in very impressive way the unequal cost that poor Black girls in the United States, Ghana, and South Africa bear while striving to achieve in the educational system. Shireen Wasogi is a assistant professor in learning sciences, and Shireen draws on a range of interpretive methods to study the social, historical, political, and ethical dimensions of learning. And she brings together ethnographic study of talk and interaction with cultural historical approaches to learning. So really sort of bringing the big picture into the small sort of day-to-day learning activities. She focuses on hybrid learning environments, the tensions and possibilities of political education, and the day-to-day development of scientific, social, and artistic discourse and practice. So we're super excited to have Sally and Shireen here. Thank you for joining us, and I think Sally will start us out.
Okay.
You have the slides up.
All right.
Thank you.
Afternoon, everyone. I have to admit that it is difficult being here on this morning with everything that's going on. But I hope that Shireen and I's presentation, or what we would actually like to call a conversation, helps us move a little closer toward justice. I'm a political scientist, but I'm really interested in schools because I really like to think about them as institutions that, instead of modeling the inequity of the world, can actually model the political equity that we seek. And so this presentation is provided sort of in that spirit. I want to start by highlighting this effort that was passed by UCLA 2 weeks ago. They basically voted to temporarily remove the SAT and ACT requirement. They joined dozens of institutions since COVID that are seeking to accommodate for the current COVID pandemic and its potential impacts on enrollment at their schools. And I bring this up because it really represents one way that institutions of higher education are thinking differently about achievement in the context of the current COVID pandemic. And so there are several ways in which institutions are going beyond that. So for example, at Northwestern, they are passing or creating pass-fail policies instead of the traditional letter grades. In elementary schools, we see the ways in which they are selectively grading. So a student is only given a grade if it helps them rather than hurts them. And so we see the ways, again, that institutions of higher education as well as elementary schools are revamping their education systems to accommodate for the current COVID pandemic. This Chronicle of Higher Ed quote, I think, really summarizes the ways in which schools are sort of halting their traditional systems and their basis for why they think this is particularly important at this time. And I'm going to read the quote. It says, "It would eliminate any problems with fairness while allowing students and faculty to focus on creating a meaningful learning experience in anxious times. I want to highlight that because I really do think that institutions view themselves as rapidly responding in order to accommodate and mitigate against fairness. However, the problem with this framing is that it assumes that there was fairness in place before COVID, and we know that that wasn't the case, right? We know that many of the problems that affect the students that we teach, learn with, that we've grown up with, preceded the pandemic, but they were very rarely addressed, and definitely not with the rapid rate in which we're seeing current institutions respond. In the U.S. alone, and again, this is before the pandemic and it persists during the pandemic, 13 million children experience hunger, and 1.5 million children experience homelessness daily. These burdens, as we know, disproportionately impact Black and Brown youth who are already dealing with exposure to systemic violence through police killings of Black people and mass incarceration, and so on and so forth. Again, many of the students that we teach, that we grew up with, that we mentor, are every day trying to think about how they're going to eat or where they're going to live. But no major policy changes in how achievement is measured are made for them. No alarms are raised. Instead, they are told to be gritty, to be resilient. They're told to lean in, to work harder, to persist. Anyone in education knows that this is the central way that people talk about responses to those who are disadvantaged and trying to navigate the educational system. In the context of the pandemic, as we would expect, these issues that I referenced in the previous slide are deepened. When you have at some point every single state closing their schools in response to COVID-19 affecting 50 million students, it's going to impact and again exacerbate the inequities that I mentioned before. And we see the ways in which schools are trying to accommodate that. So I'm going to just provide just a few quick examples of how schools are trying and some of the challenges with doing this. So in Evanston, where Northwestern is primarily located, a few weeks ago, it was reported that 4 schools opened their doors for 4 hours to distribute free meals to kids. Within 2 hours, all those meals had been taken, showing that the meals weren't just necessary for the kids, but for the families to which those kids came from. In Philadelphia, which is another city that I study, a neighborhood community organization made free meals available to residents starting at 9 a.m. Within 15 minutes, those meals were actually already taken. In Chicago, the Times reported yesterday that over 12 million meals have been distributed since the COVID pandemic began. And we know yesterday that the program was temporarily suspended and left many young people without options for food. The Reuters reported today that while institutions are doing what they can, and as I could show you through these examples, even that isn't necessarily fulfilling the need, they're still providing less meals and less services than they were when schools were intact. And we know that for many young people who were attending institutions when they were open, that already wasn't enough. But I highlight this to really demonstrate that everything I just described shows how schools are actually safety nets, a key part of our social safety net. And that really extends beyond learning. So when schools close, low-income children, of course, experience losses in their learning, but they're also without the critical supports that public schools provide. And the closure of the schools because of COVID, again, really reveal them as not these exclusive spaces of teaching and learning loss or narrow evaluations of achievement, although that tends to be the headline. It really reveals how they serve a broader civic and social purpose. And in these last few slides, I really want to sort of emphasize the ways in which schools can really be these conduits for social and political equity, arbiters of justice, and essential mechanisms for accessing what democracy promises. But all of this really requires thinking differently about achievement. Traditional achievement assumes that achievement should be measured merely by individual academic performance. So how well I do on a math exam at any given time, for example, and not by the unequal taxes levied upon an individual's maximum potential. So if I am a Black or Brown student that's also low income, what it means for me to participate and engage academically as compared to someone who doesn't fall into those categories is obviously different, right? And there's costs associated with that. Further, these notions of traditional achievement do not emphasize the need to improve the context by dismantling the patriarchal and racist structures in which Black and Brown students find themselves. So when we offer solutions around resilience, or persistence, or fill in the individual level solution, we're not actually thinking about the ways in which we really need to eliminate hunger, we need to eliminate homelessness, right? These other things that keep Black and Brown students especially at a disadvantage. In my book, How Girls Achieve, I really kind of think about what I call net achievement. And it's really a reimagination of achievement as primarily the absence of damage from experiences with learning in and outside of the school. I call this net achievement. The term net implies that the inequitable social, emotional, and physical costs of academic achievement are taken into account. So the cost, for example, of experiencing the disproportionate death of Black men, women, and trans individuals at the hands of police. Again, another issue that preceded COVID and was just further deepened during the COVID pandemic, or learning that your racial group is disproportionately devastated by COVID, but being expected to learn and achieve as normal. So here I'm thinking about the fact that many of the accommodations that have been made for young people, pass-fail policies have been made for everyone. But we do know that, for example, Black students are experiencing a special form of devastation because they're the primary target of violence, right? And so that means, by definition, that passing a policy that's applicable to everyone is actually inequitable. And I can give other examples. For example, higher education institutions that are highly ranked, but that have high rates of sexual violence and sexual assault. And my definition of achievement, that actually wouldn't be a high achieving institution, but currently that still can be. And that I think is problematic. So conceiving of achievement in the way that I'm describing really requires us to rid ourselves of false notions of merit, this supposed fairness that we had before the pandemic, that allows systems of racism and sexism to flourish because they really ignore wildly the impacts that these traditional notions of achievement have on perpetuating injustice. Net achievement recognizes that even once this pandemic ends, our inequities, racism and sexism and so on and so forth, will still be here. So this idea that we're temporarily accommodating students because of a uniquely unfair time really doesn't have a lot of basis in the ways that I'm thinking about the work that achievement can do. Ultimately, traditional achievement may be the marker of success in an inequitable society, but in an inequitable society, it is a myth. In an inequitable society, it is imperative that schools do not harm their students. And we harm our students when we force them to endure a defunct grading schema in the name of an achievement that invisibilizes their struggles. And so while institutions are, again, finding rapid, unprecedented ways to respond to the COVID crisis, it's really important that they take the time to transform these short-term COVID-related grade accommodations into permanent justice-rooted initiatives that radically reimagine achievement altogether. It's my view that in this way, our schools can start to model the political equity that we seek in this world. And with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Ariel and Klaus, I'm not able to share my screen if you can make me a co-presenter.
Yes, just one second. Ahmed? Okay, you should be able to do that now, Shuri.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you to the Buffett Institute for organizing this important conversation. And thank you to Sally for opening. I think people are going to notice a lot of connections between what I thought would be important to share and what Sally offered. I just want to pick up on particularly the last point that Sally made about what political equity can look like in schools, and sort of expand that from my perspective as a learning scientist. And to just kind of introduce myself in that perspective, I wanted to start with these three questions, which are questions that I've been wrestling with alongside wonderful colleagues and students over the last probably 20 years as an educator, as a researcher, as a designer of learning environments. And that I think take on particular valence and importance in this particular historical and political moment. So those questions are, how can we reimagine teaching and learning towards just futures? What constitutes meaningful and transformative learning for our young people? As mentioned in the introduction, I do ethnographic and interactional research. So with this second question, I really try to think about what does meaningful and transformative learning look like and feel like for young people in moment-to-moment interactions within learning environments. And lastly, I don't think we can actually answer these questions unless we ask about the deeper purposes of education and articulate what we believe to be the deeper purposes of education. In this moment in particular, I think justice-minded teachers, students, school leaders, and scholars are pushing us to both see the ways that the pandemic is revealing and exacerbating educational and social inequity, but also to take responsibility to understand this moment as a real opportunity to reimagine education. And so what I wanted to do today is just offer three ideas that I think can support this crucial work of reimagination. And I'll start here. Teaching and learning should be rooted in and arch towards the lived experiences, needs, knowledge, and well-being of students and communities. And I say rooted in and arch towards because a large body of critical research on justice-oriented education has shown that social relationships characterized by respect, by trust, by love, and culturally and politically relevant knowledge production need to be understood both as the fundamental starting points and as the purposes and goals of education and human development more broadly. So what does this mean? This means that children and youth are seen as respected thinkers who are actively engaged in making sense of the world around them, and that if education is going to matter to them, it must connect with their real questions, ideas, and concerns. While many caring teachers in this moment are working double, triple time to meaningfully serve and connect with students, our educational systems more broadly, I think, are ill-prepared for this moment, in part because we haven't been grounding teaching and learning in children and young people's everyday lives and in their well-being. Children like 9-year-old Judea Reynolds, who witnessed the police murder of George Floyd, and many children like her who witness police violence and other forms of structural violence every day. Rather than supporting students to make sense of what they are seeing and feeling through honest and nourishing curriculum and pedagogy, I think we are well practiced in implicitly or explicitly telling children to ignore how they are feeling, ignore what is going on in their everyday lives and in the social and political world, and do their quote unquote work. And I think this connects really closely to what Sally offered in terms of discourses of grit and resilience and hard work and the ways that they impact Black and Brown students, poor students, working class students in particular. And I think that word work is actually really significant. That is our primary discourse. Students talk about doing their work. Teachers talk about students doing their work. And I think that is indicative of the way that we position children as workers and laborers rather than as learners. And hand in hand with that, I think this is important to say, we are well practiced at allowing white middle class and upper class children to live life in a bubble and not to contend with the deep ethical and political challenges that they have inherited. So around the world, we see a shift to distance learning that largely reinforces teaching and learning methods that we know are not good for students' critical thinking and well-being, and that reinforce the idea of education as content delivery. Some of the students I've had the opportunity to speak to recently, high school students in systems like CPS and Chicago Public Schools, described learning during the pandemic as quote unquote robotic rather than human. And I think that speaks to the ways that the deeper purposes and meanings of learning are often absent. So I just want to make a point here and then shift to talking about what it will look like to reimagine that I think for these reasons, access to technology, is necessary but insufficient for just learning. And I think we should be wary of discourses that equate getting devices into kids' hands with equity. And I think we need a broader imagination for what meaningful distance learning can look like, which I'll speak to in a moment. And I think building on what Sally offered in thinking about testing and high stakes testing and our grading regimes in particular, one of the consequences of this philosophy and approach to education that characterizes our systems is that our systems often mistake legitimate disinterest and disconnection with a deficit view of students' capabilities. And I think that that speaks to the idea that we are vastly overlooking the potential and capabilities of our young people. So to shift a little bit, these are some of the contexts that I've had the opportunity to work in as an educator and as a researcher, and I won't go into detail into each of them. But I will say that these are settings that are hybrid settings. They're after school, they're in the summer, they're kind of trying to bring together some of the basic elements of school with what we know to be rich about out of school learning and settings. And I think that these are spaces where I've learned the ways educators and students are trying to imagine and enact educational possibility. And these are settings that are trying to build towards intellectual respect and intellectual joy as fundamental parts of the experience of the learning environment. And building from what I've learned about social and cultural and political education in these contexts, I think in the present moment, we can think about at least two major social and political events that students should have space with caring adults to make sense of and respond to as young people. The pandemic itself and the political and economic responses to it, and the national and global uprisings taking place demanding justice for Black communities and an end to police violence and structural violence more broadly. And I think prioritizing well-being means making space to meaningfully analyze these events, to support young people in taking action at micro and macro scales, and to engage in forms of healing and joy that nourish and sustain our young people. And I also think, just speaking back to the distance learning point, that well-being also means prioritizing children and young people's need to connect with one another. Too many times children are logging into Zoom or different kinds of distance learning platforms and listening to the teacher and seeing their friends and seeing their peers, but not being supported to meaningfully engage with their peers, which I think is crucial to the ways that we understand mental health and well-being, particularly in this moment of social distancing. Finally, I want to make a point here about disciplinary learning and disciplinary domains, because I think that too often the conversation about well-being and about social and emotional learning is treated as separate from academic and disciplinary domains, which is telling in and of itself. But I think that across our disciplines, we can imagine the ways that intellectual work and academic engagement can be deeply tied to questions of social and political and ecological well-being. So just to give two examples, I think in history courses and in literature courses, we need to be helping young people understand what it means when the President of the United States refers to those protesting police violence as domestic terrorists. We need to support students to understand the role that the US military has played around the world and what it means for it to turn on its own people in this moment. We need to support critical media literacy and critical literacy so that people have skills to understand and disentangle when the media treats the destruction of property as more important than the destruction of human life. And in the sciences and the STEM fields, in science, technology, engineering, and math, I think one of the things that has really struck me as an educator in this moment is that the country that is often held up as the kind of scientific powerhouse, as the center of scientific research and knowledge production, has been unable to take care of its people at the most basic level. And I think part of what that shows us is that our scientific knowledge production has been too often aimed at economic motives and profit and at military supremacy and not at ecological and human well-being. And I think that we have an opportunity, and many of the folks that I'm lucky enough to work with here at Northwestern and within the field have been working on this. We have an opportunity to radically reimagine what STEM education can look like, what social studies, what civic education and literacy education can look like in the service of these questions, which are front and center for our children and young people in their everyday lives. So I just want to make one last point here, which is that this broad reimagination of the processes and purposes of education, which many folks have been doing and incubating and practicing in schools and community-based educational spaces, is not, in my view, a choice, but a deep societal and moral imperative that this moment is making very vivid. The second point I wanted to make here is that teaching and learning are everyday human activities that emerge in and through intergenerational relationships in families, communities, and schools. What's important about this is that I think the narratives that we often get about educational equity in this time look like this, look like pandemic achievement gaps, look like learning loss. People talk about the COVID slide. And there's some importance to these conversations, and I think this connects to the inequities that are being exacerbated, as Sally was talking about. But these discourses reinforce the idea that learning is the property of schooling and not a fundamental human activity that happens throughout the spaces of our everyday lives, in families, in out-of-school learning spaces, in peer relationships and friendships, in online spaces and social media, and in communities more broadly. They also miss the intense learning and sense-making and development that children and youth are engaged in this moment. Equally important to this are the ways these narrow views of learning reinforce deficit views of families and families of color in particular. There was an NPR headline a few weeks ago that said something like, parents are being asked to be teachers to their children for the first time. And I think these narratives are important to call out, as if parents, caregivers, grandparents, aunts and uncles are not children's first teachers and do not have deep knowledge and wisdom, not only about how to support their children, but also about their own communities' histories and knowledge. So, given the massive global shift towards having children at home rather than in school, one that discourses of learning loss only position in negative terms, what can we learn from having children spend extended time in family and community contexts? How can we understand the ways parents are expanding and deepening their roles in their children's sense-making and development? How can we as a society learn from this potential restoration of familial relations to create an educational system that meaningfully partners with and learns from parents and caregivers? I think these questions and their underlying values would lead to very different designs of learning and forms of partnership between teachers and parents, rather than simply positioning parents to monitor the kinds of content delivery that too often characterize distance learning and that add stress to what are already stressful familial contexts in the political and economic moment that we're in. I think we can also learn from the teachers who are doing this work every day, often in spite of what they are mandated to do, thinking about the forms of professional learning and teacher development that are required to support these kinds of reimagination. And I think this is particularly important as we look ahead to the fall. Whether we're face to face in some kind of hybrid system or continue online, teachers need support in helping their students navigate grief, fear, and the kinds of righteous critique and rage we have seen over the past week, and all of the other emotions that children and youth are carrying in this time. And I want to make one other point here, which is that because of the kind of work that I do, you know, and as I've shared so far, in these reflections, I think there's a need for social and culturally and politically relevant education and to create spaces for young people to process what's happening, to have conversations with one another and with their teachers. But knowing what we know about the demographics of our teachers in our public school systems and the demographics of our kids, I think we also have to be careful and to provide the right kinds of teacher training, racial literacy, critical consciousness, and support for how to carefully open these spaces that can otherwise do harm. So I'll end by saying on this point that I think we have to recognize that for many children and young people, being at home has created a complex web of emotions and thoughts that include missing teachers and friends, reconnecting in new ways with parents, siblings, and cousins, and also navigating what may be difficult relationships at home. We also know that many young people of color are both shouldering the kinds of stress that Sally was referring to in terms of economic and food insecurity, and also gaining some respite from the daily forms of racial animosity, micro and macroaggressions that they experience in schools. And I think we have to hold those complexities about this moment. So I think our schools and education systems should be listening much more to young people. I wanted to share a brief quote from two middle school students who I interviewed last summer who had out-of-school learning experience. I often ask kids who've had a meaningful out-of-school learning experience a question like, what do you think schools could learn from this space? What do you think schools could learn from this program? And these two boys in particular said, educators and mentors here know how to be kind and help you at the same time. It shouldn't be like learning can't be fun. And this is something I hear very often from children when they reflect on learning environments that they find to be nourishing and expansive, whether in school or out of school. And so I think we should be asking children and youth what they miss about school, what they want to come back to, and what they do not miss or want to come back to. And I think we should be supporting them to become partners in reimagining education more broadly. So I'll just mention the third point and then open it up for questions. And I think this is also speaking to scholars and researchers, which is that I think educational design, research, and practice are political and ethical acts that can either facilitate the return to an unjust and untenable, quote unquote, normal, or help to create just futures where children, youth, and families thrive. And I think I have been heartened by the number of educators and school leaders and teachers and scholars who are really trying to take this moment as an opportunity to reimagine. And I've also been disheartened by what I see as a lack of leadership at times to critique discourses of a return to normal as what should be we should be thinking about post-pandemic. So I wanted to offer these resources as some folks that I continue to learn from as a way to end, and I'd be happy to share additional resources as well. So thank you.
Can you hear me? Thank you. Well, thank you both for you know, the really profound sort of analysis and a really deep insight into how our educational system works and how it's been affected. We have a number of questions that have come through from our participants. I want to start with one that is relatively simple or straightforward, and I think it mainly refers to Sally's presentation. What is achievement? What would sort of a positive notion of achievement look like, or is the very idea of achievement itself so flawed that it's not really useful for a way to think of learning and in education?
I think that the fundamental basis for traditional notions of achievement are inherently problematic. That's not to say that measuring or recording, you know, a person's ability to determine if 1 + 1 = 2 is not important. I think that in itself has a place. I mean, even in my work, I really talk about how I'm thinking about what it means that if a person answers correctly 1 + 1 = 2, you know, what does that actually mean in the context of people who are coming into educational spaces from just different starting points into the world? And so on one end, it can mean that the student who gets that answer correct is an excellent student and cognitively more superior. on the other hand, we know that that student likely is coming in, or that another student is coming into a context, maybe not having learned those materials, not that they can't learn, but that they haven't had the same advantages. Typically, what we would do is we would still just reward the person who got the answer correct, and that would suggest that they are a top student. And I think that that logic is a little challenging for me because we're not actually, that doesn't tell us much. And so I give an example from my own teaching. Oftentimes in class, there's students that come in much more prepared than others. And if they continue to do well, that doesn't mean I taught them anything. It just means that I'm advantaging people who were already advantaged. And what value is that really? And so my concern is that as we think about the way achievement currently, and as those things are being upended during the COVID pandemic, it really is revealing not just that these inequities already existed, but that actually institutions have the power to create rapid responses and unprecedented changes in order to make things more fair. So when people say, well, how do we do this? I'm like, institutions are already starting to do that work, and let's keep pushing in that direction, not to return to a normal perception that, you know, we can continue to give people A's A's if they came in at a disadvantage, and then giving them lower grades if they came in at a disadvantage, just assuming that that's just the way the world works. But that if institutions are creating pass-fail policies, doing selective grading, and trying to already think about ways that they can actually be fair in the context of this uniquely unjust moment, then let's keep going in that direction. And so I like to think about trying to really promote these sort of new initiatives that are already happening and deepening those and furthering those. In the book, I also talk about, and in the presentation, I gave the example of the fact that I also see the fact that institutions aren't actually capturing their rates of racial oppression, sexual harassment, sexual violence, rape, and so on and so forth as also part of the problem. Because it's currently the case that you can still be a high achieving institution, a top ranked institution, regardless of if your students are experiencing racism or sexism or so on and so forth. And so I think another practical way of moving forward is thinking about what that high ranking means, or what it means that your students are doing so well as compared to the rate and where you rank in terms of racial oppression, systemic violence, sexism, right? In terms of the cost that students are bearing to attend your institution every day. And so I'll stop there because I've been talking for a while, but those are some ways in which I think that we can start to think about achievement in a more justice-oriented way.
Maybe we're getting lots of questions, so this is fantastic. Maybe a couple of follow-ups that are more specific to sort of what happens in schools and what can happen in schools and sort of the learning that happens there. So I'm going to bundle two or three of them and feed them to you. Where do you see the role of the arts, music, culture that fit into sort of different concepts of education and learning? And related to that, is there a shift to experiential learning that sort of takes a very different approach to the educational experience? And what would it take for different pedagogies to be embraced, and how should we sort of promote those moving forward?
I can jump in on that. I think it's a wonderful question. The first thing I'll say around the culture point is that I think it's important to recognize that schools and all learning environments are already cultural. And the question is whether that culture is treated as invisible and the norm, which is often what happens. We often have schooling and academic achievement organized around white middle-class culture, but treated as normal, treated as invisible. And so I think culture is already there. It's just a question of whose culture is represented. But having said that, I think that I think the arts and music are crucial. And I think linking those two questions together, one of the ways that we can think about this, and every time I talk about kind of schools and systems, I think it's important to recognize that there are many, many powerful teachers who are disrupting these systems every day in their classrooms and doing the really important work of reimagining and incubating actually and practicing this type of more expansive and creative learning within environments that are often highly constrained. But speaking broadly about systems, I think we've organized our schooling more towards knowledge consumption than we have towards knowledge production. We are not in the habit of positioning students as producers of knowledge and as creative and critical thinkers. And I think the stripping away of arts, of music, of enriched kind of activities, and the focus on not only math and reading, but a narrow approach to math and reading is one of the ways that this plays out in school to the detriment of our society in terms of the kinds of thinkers and political actors we could be developing, and also to the detriment of young people's everyday well-being, especially in the face of the inequities that both Sally and I were referencing. And I think related to that on the cultural piece, one of the things that's hopeful about this moment is that we are not starting from scratch As we do the work of reimagining learning and education, there are many, many models across disciplines. I'm thinking about ethnic studies. I'm thinking about the work that my colleague Megan Bang and her colleagues have been doing on Indigenous science education to reimagine STEM learning. I'm thinking about all of the examples of English teachers work in literacy that is trying to disrupt and reimagine the quote unquote canon, and asking after different forms of storytelling and different stories from cultural histories and communities. There are many examples that we can draw from, models, frameworks, practices, and insights that I think we can lift up and figure out together how to systematize rather than treat as the aberration. And so perhaps that's a hopeful way to think about what's possible in this moment.
Maybe we can sort of address the system level and the sort of institutional level sort of challenges in a more direct way too. So there were a couple of questions around the pressures and demands on schools as our sort of primary institution of learning that keep them from adopting some of those different practices and sort of really reimagining themselves. And this is sort of the examples are, you know, how about employers and labor markets and what they ask for? How about political elites and what they would like schools and institutions of learning to look like? So can you comment on the sort of context in which education happens and what holds back initiatives that are already there and innovations that are already there from becoming more systemically embedded in the educational system?
I'll start, but I think, Shane, I hope that you also add. I was just going to start by saying, as I saw sort of the nuance of the question, I think it's definitely important to mention that in the United States, schools often were initiated and constructed and developed on the basis of them being spaces to contribute to the labor market, where people learn how to do the work that is required to keep the economy going. We also know that it is schools that enable or facilitate the ability for adults to go to work every day by being spaces where children can be held, right? So I fully recognize that there is a lot of institutions and powers that would love for schools to sort of remain spaces that, again, just sort of feed what it is that power brokers like want for them to sort of be. And that there's a lot of burden on institutions and parents and families and teachers already. and so to put the burden on them can be challenging. With all of that said, I do think that schools also have a history of aggression and a history of mobilization and of facilitating civic engagement. I'm a political scientist who studies schools because of that. And we know from freedom schools in the 1960s to, you know, sort of Black-led Afrocentric schools, you know, indigenous schools, these are all counter models to sort of what schools were built for. And instead, they became spaces where people learned to mobilize and to resist. And so schools have always been a place where it can actually create the kind of institutional change that I think Shane and I are describing. And it may not be that we now are looking for corporations to look like the schools we're describing, but it might be that what happens in those schools can shake up, you know, traditional corporate structures so they have to respond, right? I think that's the same thing we see in terms of movements, you know, where it's forcing people to respond, it's forcing people to pay attention. And I think that once that, and so we're talking about where to locate that initial sort of mobilization, and thinking about how schools can be spaces to locate that initial resistance and mobilization that can hopefully spread out and impact the rest of sort of the nation and the globe. And so I'll stop there.
Yeah, I just want to build on what Sally said and go back to the part of the question that's asking about like employers and the broader system and how we could impact schools. One of the not so secret secrets about school is that doing well in school and meaningful learning and thinking are not necessarily the same thing. Students often talk about doing school and learning how to do school well and play the game of what they're being asked to do in their assignments as a large part of their experience K through 12. I mean, I teach incoming freshmen at Northwestern in a summer program that is trying to create an expansive and culturally and politically relevant education. And many of our students who have done well in school by school standards talk about how this is the first time that they have been asked to really think. And I think that, and everybody can name exceptions, right? Like this goes back to what I said earlier. Everybody can say, well, I had this one teacher and it kind of feels similar to that space. So there are important exceptions always to lift up, but schooling as a whole is teaching young people to do school more than it is teaching young people to learn and think broadly. And I think that on the one hand, when we think about the job market and we think about employers within kind of a narrow capitalist frame, I think there are many people that would say that I don't want people who only think inside the box. I want people who think outside the box and are able to problem solve and navigate and think creatively on the one hand. On the other hand, what we're also seeing from the firing of Google employees who unionize or speak up about unethical practices to name, you know, name your corporation and you can find the repression and disciplining of workers who are speaking up and are critically thinking. There are certain kinds of critical thinking that our system supports, and there are other kinds of critical thinking that our system systematically does not support. And I think that that is also being revealed in this particular moment. So I think that's one piece of it that's really important. The other piece that's important here is that our discourses around education, historically in this country, our discourses around schooling have been a mix of discourses around the economy and discourses around democracy. When we think about the way the purposes of schooling are often narrated, those two things are often twin goals of schooling. And over the last couple decades, I think we've seen a narrowing of the discourse to purely economic purposes, that school is in order to train the next generation of workers and in order to engage in global economic competitiveness. And I think we should be worried about that narrowing of the discourse. And I think part of going back to the question about culture and music and the arts and this more expansive view of disciplinary learning is that I think we need an ethical language around schooling. And I think we need a broader language about learning and human development and the roles that schools alongside other institutions and environments can play in that, rather than this narrow kind of economic discourse that we've moved toward, especially over the last few decades.
Excellent. A follow-up question on I think what both of you just shared. Do you see any sort of models or positive examples of educational systems, either in the US or around the globe, that do a much better job at addressing this in a comprehensive way, rather than sort of isolated initiatives that sort of only address one piece of the puzzle? I guess in different words, has anyone actually gotten it right? Are there models that we can follow? And that's both related to educational practice, but are there also examples of movements, civic initiatives that have shown how to transform those systems? So are there positive examples for both the transformation and the kind of educational system that we would like to have?
I guess I'll start. I'm going to start actually with the individual level example. So there's a school that I chronicle in my book that I say sort of approximates this institution that I have in mind. And I've been thinking a lot about that because I think that in this current moment of injustice against Black women and men and trans individuals, you know, at the hands of police, I think their students are probably more prepared than I think most other students because of the work that they were already doing. So for example, they were already doing sort of restorative justice practices in their schools. So in that case, having a school that models the kind of relationship that we want with the justice system, right, that we don't actually have in the nation. And that's why I referenced restorative justice. They also had a curriculum that was steeped and rooted in justice. So when Tamir Rice is killed and Rukia Boyd is killed, and these are young people, and they are also young people at this school, they have these letter writing activities and campaigns, and their entire curriculums and assignments are around processing that trauma that's associated with that, right? They were doing this before pandemic, before the recent killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And so they're in a position now where the costs associated with being Black and Brown youth in America are being sort of accounted for in the way they're thinking about their education. And I can give other examples of that. I think at a more systems level, and I do work in Ghana, South Africa as well, and I can give similar examples of individual institutions, right, that are sort of thinking ahead of the fact that some kids are born into this world at a disadvantage for no fault of their own. And so they're going to inevitably have certain experiences with racism and sexism and transphobia. And so we can get ahead of that and take that into account the way that we think about our curriculum and our practices every day by starting by actually evaluating, right, our practices in itself, which is a starting point that many institutions sort of don't even do now. So this is not actually as radical as people think. It's really about centering and actually acknowledging that this is an issue and that you should evaluate where your institution stands and its practices in terms of hiring, in terms of everyday curriculum, in terms of its own mobilization, in terms of its lobbyists, in terms of where it invests its money, right? It's actually taking a look at what the institution does and does not do and trying to root it in justice. At a more systems level, there's the community schools movement. There's a lot of good work happening in Ohio, some work in Chicago and Philadelphia, where I study school closures primarily, actually. Many schools are closed because the idea is that many of the Black or Brown majority institutions aren't meeting the sort of performance criteria as measured in the traditional way. And these schools are clinics, they're providing flu shots, they're doing a lot of the community sort of work that's necessary before a child can even learn. And they're saying that, you know, those things should matter too. In fact, they probably should even matter more, right? And so those are system level initiatives that I think really do help to think differently about how we measure if an institution is doing well and offers a model for what can be, I think, spread globally.
Do you think as a very brief follow-up, do you think there's a danger in making schools sort of the focal institution for taking on many tasks that governments should or could provide in many other ways? So the food distribution is one example. Is this actually something that we would want schools to do, or is it just schools have to step in because we don't have better systems in place?
Do you want to go first and then add your
question? Yeah, go for it. I can go after you.
Sure. Okay. I was just going to quickly say that I'm glad you asked that question. It's something that I, as well as the people who I work with, especially on school closures work, think a lot about. Because a big reason why schools are playing this critical role is because the social safety net has been eroded. I do think it's actually super important, so I'm so glad you asked this question, that our social safety net be invested in. Certainly if it was the case that kids were fed, you know, in this developed country and kids had homes and, you know, just basic safety, right? And didn't have to experience sort of racism daily, that schools wouldn't have to step in this way, right? But it is the case that they do, in part because the social safety net has been consistently eroded, right? So that's certainly the case. So I sort of see them as sort of, I see that we need to invest in the social safety net primarily. That's extremely important, which requires, honestly, a completely different kind of way of thinking about the welfare system, but that's a discussion for another day. But it's also the case that schools are always going to be, as long as they're rooted in community, a critical part of that social safety net. And so they should be still invested in with that in mind.
Yeah, and just to build on that, I think what Sally said is absolutely right. And I think that there is this really deep tension around the idea that schools play this outsized role also while they're not invested in. I think that's important to say, like, we have disinvested in schools systematically while they're playing this social safety role, speaks to the kinds of inequities that are built into the system. That we treat schools as a place for the opportunity for upward mobility while the economic and racial inequities are built in the system for families and for their parents and for the people, the broader communities. And so I just think that that is reflective of that. And I think it goes back to your earlier question, Klaus, about examples. On the one hand, this is not, it's not a mystery what children need. You know, if you look at any private school, if you look at any well-resourced school, it is not a mystery that questions of class size and nurses and social workers and well-trained teachers and support systems on the one hand. And so it's a question of who gets those resources. On the other hand, I think that schooling as an institution, as one way of doing teaching and learning, has built into it the reproduction of inequality, the idea that we are sorting and ranking children and young people according to particular narrow definitions of learning, and then going on to structure society based on those hierarchies, is a global challenge of schooling. And I think that we have an opportunity to rethink schooling in and of itself, and to rethink the kinds of human development that can become possible if we understand the project of education as tied towards broader goals of transformation and liberation, rather than as a mechanism for reproducing hierarchy.
Thank you. Very brief, sort of, I guess, as sort of closing statements from both of you. What should schools prioritize as they return to instruction in the fall in one way or another? And I deliberately won't call it, you know, post COVID, or, you know, cause there's no post pandemic, there's no post, you know, racism. It's basically in our current state. What would you tell?
I'm as glad about this question as Sally. About the last question, I'm glad you asked that question. I think that well-being, young people's well-being, and the restoration and deepening of social relationships, of nourishing social relationships, should be the number one goal. We are experiencing various forms of trauma as a society. As Sally spoke about earlier, that trauma has been differentially experienced for many, many years, decades, centuries. But we are experiencing collectively in this moment, and I would say on this day, in this week, particular forms of collective trauma that I think schools need to be critically supported and prepared to privilege, and not to tell students to put down their head and do work that is disconnected from what is happening. And I think one of the comments I often make in thinking about kind of socially and politically relevant education, it doesn't mean just talking about the inequities and the pain and the despair. It also means meaningfully supporting young people to feel a sense of radical hope and agency in this moment. And I think that goes hand in hand with the privileging of well-being, of processing, and of the social relationships that I think are the cradle for the types of mental and intellectual health that we're trying to develop for young people. And as I said earlier, I am a firm believer that that is not separate from the curriculum, that if we can reimagine curriculum and pedagogy towards those ends, then we can do it all. But I do feel that that social relationships and young people's well-being should be the priority.
There's not much more to say. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. Well-being extremely important. And honestly, like I said, maybe if society were different, then we could just go carry on and care about, you know, the work of achieving a particular grade. But in the absence of that, while injustice is sort of the central way of the world, it's important to prioritize, as Shane said, well-being and eliminating the racist structures and sexist structures that are obscuring people's lives.
you. I think we've reached the end of a fascinating and really important conversation that I'm sure we could continue on for hours and many more seminars. But for today, we've come to an end. So thank you so very, very much, Sally and Shireen. And thanks everyone for joining us today for the webinar. For the participants, you expect to receive a link with a survey, which we hope you share your feedback for us. We will continue the series. The next session will be next Tuesday, June 9th, and we will have Professor Beth Redbird, who is an assistant professor in sociology at Northwestern, and her colleague Timofey Bricks, who's a professor in policy research at Kiev School of Economics. And they will lead a conversation about the real-time research that they're doing on the social and cultural impacts of COVID-19 in the US and the Ukraine. So I hope you can join us again. And thank you very much again for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. It's really good. And thanks for joining us today when I'm sure many people had many other things on their mind. We can.